Good morning and welcome to At Home This Morning, a magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a look at our world, both in and around the city of Brighton and Hove, and now even further afield, all for both our older listeners and those not so old. In the next hour, we'll be hearing from both the new owner of the Brighton Hippodrome, that's Simon Lambor from Matsim Properties, and the man who's heading up the campaign to restore it as a theatre, David Fisher. Also joining us will be the musical star Rosie Ash, who's written a show dedicated to Dora Bryan, and which Rosie will be performing as part of the Festival Fringe next month. And staying on the theme of musical theatre, Lucinda Morrison from Chichester Festival Theatre will be here with news of their revival of the 1960s hit show South Pacific. And to round things off, we'll welcome two experts. Firstly, Nabila Norman, who will have some advice on the cost of being a grandparent. And believe me, I know only too well what that means. And child psychologist Dr. Sam Vass will be here with some helpful hints on what being a grandparent can involve. But first, this was my initial comment when at long last I finally got back inside the Brighton Hippodrome with new owner Simon Lambor from local developer Matsim Properties.
Inside the Hippodrome for the first time in how long, Simon?
It's been shut since 2006. Mecca closed their doors in 2006 after it being a bingo hall for 40 years. There are some areas that were shut off by Mecca, so, you know, being seen for the first time in perhaps, you know, since the 60s.
So what are the plans?
First plan is to put a new roof over the auditorium. We need to try and save the plasterwork. We are looking to bring forward proposals for a mixed-use scheme that centres around the auditorium. We want to see the auditorium return to performance-led food and beverage offering, an entertainment and hospitality venue that ultimately is as flexible as possible and can be interacted as much as possible by Brightonians and by visitors to Brighton. It wasn't built as a lyric theatre, it was built as an ice rink, and then it was a variety theatre and a music hall, and it's been any number of different entertainment venues, and it's a wonderful space. We've got to try and come up with a viable use, you know, to really save the building. It needs to be a commercial use that will look after it. We aren't looking to do anything in the main auditorium in terms of reconfiguration. We're just looking to make the space as flexible as possible to allow all types of performance and enable that from happening, whether it's comedians, live music, dramatic performance, dance. We're looking to be able to enable all sorts of performance.
And local theatre groups come in and put on stage shows?
Yep. Definitely.
And how long a timescale are you looking at?
We'd like to get the new roof on this summer. We're just submitting a planning application shortly, and then onto a full planning application. It would be great if we were able to secure planning permission this year, and then possibly 18 months to 2 years of build after that. We are approaching it in a sort of phased manner whereby the auditorium will take the area of concern that we want to get up and open as soon as possible.
And looking to the future, the fly tower, whilst it's not going, it'll have another use.
Yeah, the fly tower is effectively seven stories tall, so we can reinstate the full proscenium arch whilst also providing four stories of flexible serviced office space that's then going to ensure that there's that additional footfall through the day and people are able to interact with the building even more.
And the plan to have an enabling development in the Ship Street side?
Yep, so we've just got effectively, they call it a hotel Airbnb accommodation. The idea being that it's complementary accommodation. The people who are going to be using it and staying there are going to be interacting with the Hippodrome. They're there for the reason, and so it's all complementary uses that are all centred around the auditorium.
Why did Matsim actually buy the Hippodrome in the first
place? Yeah, we're a family company, so it's not me. I'm not, I don't like being put forward as the front man. But anyway, family organisation, it's all a collective group effort. I was first contacted in 2015 about building, so I followed it ever since, and we didn't like the direction it was going. We were hearing that it was being neglected and nothing was being done. There have been other organisations pushing to sort it out, but we felt like it was, you know, it was an opportune time. Well, not an opportune time, it was the time to get involved to really save it, because it was falling into serious disrepair. If this auditorium plasterwork collapses, then it's one thing to repair it. It's another thing to recast it. You're talking about a dramatic increase in the cost that would then see the building almost unsalvageable. I can't see how it would be saved without serious, serious public grants that just don't exist.
So how do you think the public will take to the new Hippodrome?
We've opened up the front doors for the first time in a long time, and we've had probably hundreds of people through the doors now, and there's not been one negative comment. There's some people standing in awe for 15 minutes staring at the ceiling, which, yeah, it's just great to see. When we first came in and experienced the auditorium space, we approached from the rear car park from Ship Street, so we actually haven't even experience that to see it for the first time from Middle Street, which is the way that it was supposed to be seen. So, it's just great to let people know that this space is there, and I think that public awareness is just great to let people know it's here. That's going to be a big part of the viability story.
And are you looking to create not a museum as such, but the history panel somewhere within the building that people can come and see?
There's the elephant ramp, so it's you've got the old elephant house from its circus days, and the elephant and equestrian ramp that leads to the to effectively backstage. But it's a very nice atmospheric space where we'd like to do some sort of visual or audio museum.
And how can local people listening to this help you, Matt's in Properties, with the development?
I think at the minute we just as much support as we can get on the various planning applications that are forthcoming. Give it the scrutiny that's needed, but also to try and let the council know that we're on the right path, and so that we have as little resistance as possible, because it is going to be a real challenge to make this work. So yeah, we need to try and keep the momentum up.
And how can people do that?
We've got a website up at the minute where people can post comments of support, but equally, if you keep an eye out for the various planning applications, and then provide your support as and when.
Well, that was Simon Lambourne from the developers who have bought the Hippodrome, Maps in Properties. But another group have been involved in the Hippodrome, and we've been hearing over the years of their plans. And with me, David Fisher from Brighton Hippodrome CIC. David, you've heard what Simon has been saying. What's your view?
Well, all along, we've been working on this now for nearly 8 years, and our view is that it is and should remain a theatre. Simon Lambourne is quite wrong to say it never was a lyric theatre, it was built as a skating rink. It's quite true, it was built as a skating rink. It survived for 3 winter seasons and failed. It was then converted by the greatest theatre architect of the period, Frank Matcham, into a circus theatre. The circus didn't work, so they just carried on and turned it into a variety theatre, which is the same thing as a lyric theatre. And it has been that ever since. Even when Bingo came in the 1960s, they put in a flat floor and kept that for Bingo. But it was still, everything else was still there. Simon said a lot of bits were closed off for Bingo, but they didn't need some of it. They didn't need the dressing rooms and so on. But they're still there. They could go back to being a theatre.
On the financial side, I mean, that's the stumbling block, isn't it? It has to be viable.
Well, I mean, there are 2 aspects to that. One is to make sure it's viable as an ongoing concern, and there is no doubt that as a theatre it would be. We have a business plan that shows a quarterly cash flow over, I think it's 8 years, 7 or 8 years, and it's a solid, profitable business for right through that period. The problem is doing the work to restore it, and this is what is the stumbling block, really, you could say, is the what's known as in heritage circles as the conservation deficit. In other words, the amount that it would cost to do up the building compared with the actual value. And that gap has to be filled somewhere. Simon said it would have to be raised from public funds and from charities and so on, which isn't available. Well, on the contrary, it is available. I mean, there is a lot of money around if you know how to tap it. We've just commissioned some more work about how to do that, the sort of roadmap that we would need in order to raise the money to do the restoration. And we are very happy to work with Maxim. We would raise that money if they were happy to restore the building as a theatre. Unfortunately, what their plan really is, despite the way he described it, is a hotel, and the auditorium will be a sort of food court with a lot of the stage area will be turned into kitchens on the plans that we've seen. And there will be pretty minimal stage facilities and certainly hardly any dressing rooms. So when he says that you could have theatre shows, that's very unlikely. It could have stand-up comedy because somebody just stands in front of a microphone, essentially. You could have a little bit of music. And I know they've been talking, for example, to Fatboy Slim about the sort of music that could be on there. But even his sort of show probably couldn't be put on what's left of the stage as they're planning it.
So do you plan to object to their plans?
We very much support what they're doing about the roof, which is as far as it's gone at the moment. That really is an important part of it. If once that's done, it means that the building will be more or less protected from the weather, from further deterioration. It would give them time to think about what they're going to do with it. I know they've faced the problem of the cost of restoring all the plasterwork in the auditorium, which is enormous. I mean, it runs into millions. And unless they've got very deep pockets, they're going to have problems doing that. If you're going to do that, why not go the whole hog and turn it back into a theatre? Restore it as the theatre that it still is.
Your views are at odds with theirs as far as the theatre is concerned.
Yes. Brighton needs a theatre, and we don't have a large theatre in Brighton. We've got a large concert hall, we've got a large conference centre that can be used for things like that, and we've got a medium-sized theatre in the Theatre Royal. But Brighton, at one time or another, has had 8 large theatres that seated more than 1,000. The only one left is the Hippodrome, and that's really the last chance to do this sort of thing. Brighton really ought to be getting itself back on the theatre map. It's being overtaken by places like Eastbourne and the nearest big theatres are, well, Chichester, Canterbury, Southampton, Portsmouth, nothing here.
Looking to the future, how do you see those two opposing views coming together?
Well, we've shared all our plans with them. We've shown them our business plan. We've shown them all the other work that we've done. And we've also shown that to Historic England, which is responsible because it's a listed building, and to the council. We've submitted them to the planning department and had very favourable responses. We've also shown them to the elected members, who've almost, without exception, been very enthusiastic about having a theatre of this kind.
I mean, it is an amazing building. And as I said when I was talking to Simon, it's the first time I've been in there for about 50 or 60 years. And it's still magnificent. And do you think it ever will be again?
It could be. I mean, it is a question of vision, really. It's a question of setting sights high enough. I think what they're going for is a fairly easy option. Yes, it's more difficult to go for a theatre, it costs more, but we are very happy, more than happy, to work with them on raising the funds to do that.
So where do you think it goes from here?
We're still talking to the council, we're still talking regularly to the Theatres Trust, which has backed what we're proposing up to the hilt, and we're talking to Historic England. And what we hope is that those other agencies will try to persuade Maxim that they shouldn't just go for the simple option of having a food hall. It's got to be a theatre.
Now, it's not often on At Home This Morning that we feature items about the Brighton Festival Fringe. Well, there's nothing like an exception to the rule. And a venue that's new to Brighton, the Warren Oil Shed in Victoria Gardens, more about that later,
is host to a show called Adorable Dora. And it doesn't take a genius to work out that it's all about Dora Bryan. And the show is being produced and is starring an adorable person herself, Rosemary Ashe. And she's joining us now via Zoom. Rosemary, hi, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Chris. Lovely to meet you.
And you. And tell me, what's Adorable Dora all about?
Well, it's a tribute to Dora Bryan, of whom I've been a fan many, many decades. And it's telling her, talking about her life on the stage and at home, and particularly in Brighton, because, of course, she spent many, many years living in Brighton and running, her husband ran Clarges Hotel on the seafront, and she was a very, very well-known figure in Brighton, very popular figure. And talking about her incredible career, which ranged from musicals, variety, pantomime, sitcom, radio, summer seasons. I mean, she just did concert parties. She just did everything. So I'm talking about that. I have my pianist, Paul Knight, who is accompanying me when I sing some of the songs that Dora sang. And I'm embodying her. I am being her as much as I can. I mean, nobody could be her, be like her. She was a complete one-off. But it's proving a very enjoyable experience to be rehearsing and learning, I have to say.
You're no stranger to the balls yourself, are you, as far as stage is concerned?
No, I've had a long career in musical theatre, done many, many West End shows. Notably, I was in the original cast of The Phantom of the Opera, playing Carlotta, the opera singer, and also in Oliver and Les Miserables, playing Madame Thénardier and The Witches of Eastwick, things like that. So, and I've done lots of cabaret and solo performances. I wrote a show about Ethel Merman a few years ago, which I performed for many years, which I'm still performing, actually, because I'm going to be doing that in Hastings the week before I do Dora in London, before I unveil Dora. So I've got a lot going on in my head at the moment, I have to say.
Adorable Dora. Is it, what kind of show is it? Is it a cabaret?
I suppose you'd call it in that genre, really, because it's just myself and a pianist. But I do have a director, so I won't just be standing still all the time. I'll be, you know, moving about a bit. But it is essentially like a cabaret, telling her life story, yes.
So is the whole show interactive? Are you asking for people to join in and sing along with Dora?
Oh, possibly. You have to wait and see when you come. I'll certainly be talking to the audience a lot directly, as she did. I mean, that was why people loved her so much. I think she made them feel as though she was part of them, because she always said, you know, I loved the bond with an audience. Initially, there won't be, but there may be a little something for people to join in with. Yes.
And what do you think is the secret of her success?
Well, her versatility, which was incredible, because she was a fantastic dancer, a mover, and she didn't have the greatest voice. She never thought of herself as that great a singer, but she had a very serviceable voice. Her personality, of course, her warmth, being a Northern lass, and her total warmth and openness and friendliness. When I was doing research on the show, I didn't meet a single person who didn't have a good word to say about her. In fact, the title of the show came from Mark Winter, who did many shows with her, pantomimes, and he did Charlie Girl with her. And I had a long chat with him. I mean, he was with her right up to the end. He visited her in the nursing home where she was. And he said, call it Adorable Dora, because she was adored. A lot of people may not remember that she was also a very, very good straight actress. She won a BAFTA for the film A Taste of Honey, and she was at the National. She won an Olivier Award for Harold Pinter, the Birthday Party. And she also did some Shakespeare in the Park and Pygmalion on Broadway with Peter O'Toole. So it wasn't just all fun and frolic. She could be serious when she needed to be.
And as you said in your introduction, she was a hotelier. She ran Clarges Hotel on the seafront for many,
well,
many years.
It was her husband ran it, really. You know, she said it was nothing to do with her. Though I gather that she does say in her autobiography that, you know, people used to come in and say, where's Dora? And if she wasn't there, they'd get quite cross. And she said, well, honestly, it was nothing to do with me. I've since heard that occasionally if she was there and people came in, she wouldn't hesitate in doing the splits, which was her party piece, of course. she learned to do the splits. I mean, she went to dance school when she was 10 years old. And even when she was 70, she was doing the splits. Now, as to whether or not I can do the splits, bits. You'll have to find out when you come to the show.
It's a new venue for Brighton and for the show, the Warren Oil Shed in Victoria Garden. Do you know anything about that?
Well, only that it's basically four oil drums joined together with some sort of roof on, because a friend of mine saw it being sort of put up, and that's literally what it is. But, I mean, it's going to have, lighting and sound and everything. But, no, I don't. But it's in a very good location, isn't it? It's very central, so I'm very happy about that. I'm actually doing it in London first. I'm starting it off locally in Chiswick, where I live, in the Bedford Park Festival, then at the German Street Theatre, for a couple of performances, which are sold out, which is lovely, and then coming to Brighton in July.
And talking about sold out, how do people get tickets?
Basically, they'll have to go online and put into Google Brighton Fringe Adorable Dora, and it should come up and they can book online.
And finally, Rosemary, is it a show for everybody, or have you got to be a Dora Bryan fanatic?
I don't think so. I think even if you know nothing about Dora Bryan, you'll certainly learn a lot. I think it's musical theatre and theatrical history. In fact, I've just been working with some students at Arts Educational School here, and a lot of them are coming, and they'd never even heard of her because they're only in their 20s. You know, they wouldn't have known anything about her career, but they'll certainly learn a lot from it. So I think anybody would find it interesting. If you know her, if you remember her, then you may get a bit more out of it because you'll see what she was like. I mean, she was a one-off, total one-off, really. It's such a huge personality. But certainly in terms of learning things about the theatre and how it was, and learning about somebody who had all these skills and did absolutely everything. I mean, nowadays in training, we talk about students having to be a triple threat, singer, actor and dancer. And she was all those, you know. And she was born in 1924, and she started her career in 1936. You know, what can I say? So I think people will enjoy it.
We were hearing from musical star Rosie Ashe, who'll be performing the show she wrote herself, Adorable Dora, at the Warren Oil Shed, which is in Victoria Gardens, on Thursday the 8th of July at 4:40 p.m. and again on Saturday the 10th of July at 1:10. Now, I'm sure that most grandchildren really love their older relatives, but could there be an ulterior motive by way of a financial incentive, perhaps increased pocket money, that sort of thing? Well, to find out more, we're joined now by financial expert Nebula Norman, who first gave me her view on that very point.
It can be that, you know, grandparents on average give their grandchildren around £243 a year, which averages out about £4.60 a week. So that's a considerable amount of money, you know, pretty good pocket money for lots of children. You know, of course, lots of grandchildren do want to spend time with their grandparents as well, just to kind of learn from them, hear the stories, gain their experience, and have, you know, some of the kind of the learnings and traditions passed down. So hopefully, you know, money's not the only reason people want to hang out with their grandparents, you know, and grandparents provide so much, you know, unpaid childcare for their grandchildren as well. So I think there's lots of reasons, but money is certainly maybe one of them.
Has the situation changed over the decades, or has it always been thus?
I think what's happened really is that that grandparents have always provided, you know, quite a lot of unpaid childcare for their children, which meant, you know, a lot of grandchildren did grow up spending so much time with their grandparents, which is, you know, great experience and great kind of life lessons that they'll never be able to kind of, you know, get back, really. So I think these are kind of times and moments that should be cherished. I think one of the key things that that grandparents do is spend, you know, a lot of money on their grandchildren, not because always they're asked to do it, because they want to do it as well. And I think, you know, on top of that £243 a year, you know, grandparents do spend on average, according to our research, an additional £213 a year on things like presents and food and money and going out and maybe petrol on the way to, you know, swimming lessons or whatever. So grandparents do put a lot of time, energy and resource in their grandchildren that I hope, and I certainly hope that my grandparents felt it was kind of resource and money well spent.
It is indeed, and certainly I don't begrudge a penny of the money that goes in that direction to my grandchildren. But is this something that is particularly relevant in the UK, or is it worldwide?
I think, you know, I think it's worldwide. You know, different countries have different trends. And certainly if you think about Japan, that has, you know, quite an older population, you know, it's about generational money. So, you know, grandparents end up living with their children quite a lot. And so, you know, the time and energy and resource that the grandparents put into their children and grandchildren then, you know, gets spent on them as they get older as well. So so I don't think it's just the UK. And I think, you know, lots of different countries, you know, encourage grandparents to save and to give to their grandchildren. You know, it's not always easy being able to afford to give to your grandchildren if you don't have the money. And I would say, you know, start early, you know, maybe before the pregnancy announcement, get into kind of good savings habits. If you can put a pound away or 50p, if you want to try and save for when you've got a grandchild, if you are fortunate to have, you know, a lump sum, try putting it away into something like a fixed rate bond. And then, you know, the longer you lock it away, the better the return, really. So I think there's lots of things that grandparents can do if they do want to, you know, have that money to kind of spend on their grandchildren in the future.
Two questions. One, the question of taxation, because we are only allowed to give our grandchildren and our children a very limited amount of money, otherwise they'll get taxed. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right. So there is, you know, a tax-free kind of gift allowance. I think for children, it's something like £7,000each tax year. And for grandchildren, it's slightly more. But what I would do is recommend you going to our website, raisin.co.uk, and we've got a page there all around saving for your grandchild. So if you want to open a junior ISA or, you know, an easy access or some kind of notice account, you can do that really easily. And we kind of tell you, give you kind of hints and tips and tell you what you can and can't do, really. So you don't have to kind of struggle on your own. Just take 10 minutes, do a bit of research, and you can really kind of find out quite a lot about where you can put your money and where it's best placed for the future.
That was Nebula Norman talking about the cost of being a grandparent. And on a similar note, we're told that grandparents are important to a child's development. Well, how important? Well, joining us to tell us all about it, Dr. Sam Waz, who's a child psychologist. Good morning.
Morning, Craig.
How important are grandparents and great-grandparents?
Yeah, so this is a really, really important issue, Chris, that we're really, really keen to raise awareness of for this campaign with Megabus. So there's been a massive amount of research coming out over the past 5 to 10 years about things like loneliness, so lack of social contact, and how that affects not just our mental health outcomes, so things like anxiety and depression, but also our physical health outcomes. So not just, you know, we all develop aches and pains as we get older. And there's a lot of research suggesting that you just become more aware of those aches and pains when you don't have so much to take your mind off it. So obviously, in terms of how we feel about our physical health, that's really, really important. But the other thing that there's a lot of research on is just the effect of social contacts on improving really hardcore things like our life expectancy. So people who have more physical contact, particularly more social contact, you know, actually physically live longer. So really, really important thing to be raising awareness of.
And how important to the child is contact with the grandparents?
Yeah, so this is another area, and it really is bi-directional. So grandparents and great-grandparents benefit massively from spending time with their grandkids. But also it's the other way around. So grandkids learn a lot from their relationships with their grandparents, particularly over the past year. Something that a lot of parents have been saying to me, and we've experienced it in our family, is just having to play so many different roles as a parent is really, really has been really, really challenging. So, you know, you're managing the homeschooling, so you're having to be the educator and the disciplinarian. You're providing, you're putting the food on the table, you're getting them dressed in the morning, but you're also having to be the playmate, the fun one that they play with at the end of the day. And what's lovely now, we're starting to have these more different relationships coming in. So children are spending time with their parents and then with their grandparents, is these roles can be split up more. So the lovely thing about being a grandparent is just you don't have to do the boring stuff. You're only there for the fun stuff. So you're not responsible for, you know, putting the food on the table in most families, at least. But you are there for the fun time. So really, really important for kids. They benefit massive amount of time. They benefit massively from having these relationships where it really is just about having fun. You know, it's not about the sensible, you know, boring stuff. So really, really important both ways.
And you said both ways just then. So it's important for the mental well-being of the older person as well.
Yeah, definitely. So particularly one thing that with this campaign with Megabus, which we're trying to get across, is the difference of physical contact. So this is what so many of us have been missing in our families over the past year or so. And there really is a lot of research suggesting that physical contact really has a big effect on us, and it's all beneficial. So it sets off this cascade of chemicals through our body. You know, I'm very aware of it, so I can really feel it, you know, the effect that a hug is having on you. The effect has these chemicals, things like oxytocin, have an effect on our feelings of connectedness. So hugs make us feel much more connected with other people, but also they have an effect on our relaxation. So hugs almost for everybody are immediately relaxing, which is obviously particularly important at the moment, given what a stressful and anxiety-filled time it's been for over the past year.
And what about the health issues of hugging children? We know that they're often the bearers of germs one way or another. Should we ignore that?
No, it's about being sensible and doing it in the prescribed way, you know, particularly watching out for immunizations and, you know, checking that most children are getting COVID tested quite regularly at school. So checking that, you know, it can be done in a way that everybody considers safe. You know, a lot of care has gone into, you know, we realize now, and a lot of kind of attention has been paid from scientists about how important these things are, how important physical contact is. And it's been about kind of helping people to manage it in a way that is safe. So there are definite benefits to be got from having those hugs and having that physical contact. Obviously, though, you know, it needs to be done in a way that's kind of COVID secure. So, you know, there's a lot of guidelines out there about, you know, managing and making sure that you've been immunized and that the kids have been regularly tested. And, you know, it's definitely a safe thing to be do. But, you know, you definitely concretely miss out on things if you don't let that happen. So, you know, really, really important to see both sides of the equation.
And finally, golden rules.
I think, Chris, the really important thing in terms of meeting up is, you know, realizing that it's a big transition back for many grandparents and for many grandkids, particularly, you know, some families have been having a lot of screen time. In a lot of families, the grandparents and the great grandparents haven't, you know, felt able to kind of manage that transition to having a lot of screen interaction. So a lot of grandparents haven't actually seen their grandkids for a long period of time. So in those types of kind of families, it's more of a bump back into the transition. So it's things like having some toys on hand to play with. You know, everybody is more relaxed if there's something else to focus on. It doesn't take long to childproof a house. You know, in my family, we go around and tie together any cupboards that have got any valuables in, just tie them together with a tight, you know, it takes 10 minutes and really makes everyone feel kind of more happy and secure. So kind of lots of things that can be done with a bit of pre-planning can make it into the, you know, really relaxing and really, really important kind of reunion that it should do. The really important message, though, Chris, is, you know, everybody's been craving this. So this came across really strongly from this survey from Megabus, just, you know, how much grandparents and great grandparents have been missing the physical contact. And a lot of the time, you know, the things that we crave are really the guilty pleasures. And this really is a very different thing. We crave it, but it's also really, really good for us, really, really good for our physical and mental health. So one of those nice things that we really want to do it, and it's good for us too. So, you know, really something to be enjoyed.
Well, I'll take you back to the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, in 1951, would you believe, when South Pacific opened on the stage. And that was later followed by the film South Pacific, which ran for an incredible 4 years at the Dominion Theatre in London. The reason I'm telling you all that is that South Pacific opens Chichester Festival Theatre from the 5th of July, so just a couple of weeks' time. And joining us to tell us all about the show and Chichester Festival Theatre is Lucinda Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. Lovely to be talking to you again.
It's lovely. Absolutely. And you're back in the theatre, I gather.
I am back in the theatre, yes. After many months, like other people, working from my kitchen table and my sort of garden shed, it's fantastic actually to be back in the theatre in the offices here, yes, surrounded by other people and everything gearing up again, which is great.
The theatre is going to be home to Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific.
Yes, it is. And again, that's something we've waited a long time for, because originally it was going to be the centrepiece of Festival 2020, obviously last year, and that didn't happen for obvious reasons. So fortunately, we've been able to hold on to the rights and all the leading cast members as well. And so now we've got a huge company, actually, 31 adult actors plus 6 children and 15 musicians. And they are all starting rehearsals there at the moment. They're in London, but they're coming down to Chichester. And that's when we will really feel we're back in business again, to have a big musical company with us.
For those that don't know, South Pacific is a bit controversial, isn't it? Or was at the time?
It was at the time. I mean, it's unusual, really, I think, for a musical, in that it was based on a book called Tales of the South Pacific, which was written by James Michener about his experiences in the South Pacific during the Second World War. I mean, it's set in the Second World War in 1943, when huge numbers of American troops, Marines, were sent out to the South Pacific, obviously to fight the Japanese, and found themselves on these islands that had always been a sort of a melting pot in many ways. You had the native sort of Polynesians, but there'd been a huge wave of immigration over the years, particularly from people that were then known as the Tonkinese Chinese, which were from what we now know to be northern Vietnam. And of course, the French had been there as well. So you've got this huge sort of clash of cultures in many ways. French plantation owners, as you say, the native Polynesians, the immigrant Tonkinese, and then the American troops. And it's quite a sort of a hard note. I mean, James Michener absolutely adored it. It sort of changed his life. But it's quite a tough book in many, many ways. And Rodgers and Hammerstein took, obviously, some elements of these collected tales, but they also fought very hard to keep in the theme of racial intolerance and racial prejudice, and particularly the very famous song sung in the show by young American lieutenant, Got to Be Carefully Taught, where he's talking about how racial prejudice is instilled in children from a very young age. And once you have, if you sort of inherited those attitudes, it's very, very difficult to overcome them. And a lot of South Pacific, as well as, of course, it has this glorious score, these most wonderful, you know, songs that we all know and can sing, like I Can Wash That Man Out of My Hair and Some Enchanted Evening and so on, Valley High. But it does also deal with very serious themes as well.
A lesson for today's youth?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it is extraordinary, I think, that, of course, when we planned this production and when it was, you know, meant to go on last year, of course, we didn't know about the pandemic. And everything that's happened in this last year, the huge, unfortunate rise in Asian hate crime, particularly, and the whole Black Lives Matter movement. So unfortunately, sadly, its message is all too relevant today, perhaps even more so than it would have been last year if we hadn't had the pandemic.
The casting hasn't been that straightforward, has it? You've got it. One of the cast members has become pregnant.
That's right. Yes, yes. Gina Beck, who again was you know, was cast from the very beginning. But yes, I mean, very, very happily, she discovered that she was pregnant earlier this year. So she's going to continue. She's going to open, and she's playing Nellie Forbush, the main role. She's going to open as planned. Do the thing. She'll be just about 5 months pregnant when she opens, and so, you know, she's going to be in a swimsuit and so on stage. So that's going to be interesting. And then from mid-August, Alex Young, who everybody, if you came to see Me and My Girl a couple of years ago. Might remember she played again the lead in that, Sally Smith opposite Matt Lucas. And very happily, she's going to come and share the role with Gina throughout from sort of mid-August onwards, and then take over for the end of the run from 23rd of August onwards for the rest of the run, by which time 8 shows a week will probably be too much for a 7 months pregnant Gina.
Very much so. And will the script be changed to...
No, not at all. Not at all. No, we're not changing a word of what Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote. But I think, you know, quite apart from that, we are hoping to look at the whole production in a sort of more, you know, contemporary lens and reveal its pertinence to the times as well. Yes, but not actually changing any of the script or the songs at all.
So everything that we know and love from South Pacific. Have you yourself got a favourite number?
Oh, goodness. Well, do you know, it was very interesting. Andrew Lloyd Webber doing a feature, people might know, there's a Radio 4 programme on a Saturday morning called Saturday Live, where people choose what they call their inheritance tracks, that, you know, a track that they've inherited and they would like to pass on. And the one he chose was Some Enchanted Evening, which he said is probably the greatest musical song ever composed, which is quite something coming from Andrew Lloyd Webber. And it is absolutely beautiful. But, you know, there are just so many. I mean, Younger Than Springtime, and then there's the lighthearted numbers. Obviously, There Is Nothing Like a Dame and Happy Talk. There are so, so many. But I think I've always loved, you know, I'm in love with a wonderful guy. I can't wait to hear Gina and Alex singing that.
Wonderful. And what about the practicalities of reopening the theatre? Are you going to be able to have full capacity?
As we speak, Chris, we still don't know. We are waiting for the government to tell us what is going to happen. Of course, for the last few months, we've all hoped that 21st of June will see an end to all social distancing and all restrictions. And we still don't know. As you say, as I'm talking to you today, we still don't know what the position is going to be with that. What we have decided is that we will have, even if those restrictions are lifted, we are designating one performance every week socially distanced, so that people who still aren't terribly comfortable at the thought of coming and sitting cheek by jowl with a lot of other people can still come and sit in their bubbles, and the auditorium will be reduced to 50% capacity, and there'll be all those other measures like timed arrivals and temperature checks and so on. For the other performances at the moment, we are booking with a reduced capacity. So that's about 900 people instead of 1,300 people, who at the moment, then they won't actually be seated socially distanced in the auditorium, but it does mean that there will be fewer people in the foyers and, you know, queuing for the bathrooms and all that sort of thing. If the restrictions are lifted, then we will move to full capacity, because obviously, especially for a really big show like that, it really isn't financially viable to be doing it with only 50%. But if that's what the government says we have to do, then of course that is what we'll do. And at the moment, things like mask wearing is throughout the performance is still going to be in place for everybody, regardless of which show they come to. But again, you know, as you said, we are still waiting to hear what the government guidelines will be.
And when does booking open?
Booking is now open, very much so, and tickets are going very well at the moment. There are plenty of seats. We run from the 5th of July through to the 4th of September. But yes, book now to avoid disappointment, as they say.
And the website? Detail.
It's www.cft for Chichester Festival Theatre, so cft.org.uk. Or you can ring the box office. Our phone lines are open, 01243 781 312.
I was chatting there to Lucinda Morrison from Chichester Festival Theatre with news of their eagerly awaited summer production of South Pacific, which runs from the 5th of July to the 4th of September. And my message, quite simply, don't miss it, whatever you do. And that just about brings us to the end of this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme that's brought to you by Brighton's local radio station, Radio Reverb, broadcasting on 97.2 FM, on digital radio with DAB+, and online at radioreverb.com. And so, until we next meet over the airwaves, it's goodbye from me. However, don't forget that my co-presenter Richard Davis will be here with his next edition in a couple of weeks' time. But now there's just time for me to say cheerio, and of course to remind you that for the last hour you've been listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. And you can listen again to a selection of some of the editions of the show by entering either Radio Reverb or Grey Matters Productions CIC into your internet browser, selecting the Listen Again tab, and then just select the show you'd like to hear. And so, until we next meet over the airwaves, or however you listen, this is Chris English signing off as usual with Please Keep Safe. Bye for now.